a dime, I suppose.
Welcome to Watchmen Minute, where we're discussing the 2009 Zack Snyder film Watchmen, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash from Almost Famous Minute.
I'm Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes Podcast.
All right. Is Matthew McConaughey? No, it's not really. It's Alex Thompson from Independence Day Minute and various and sundry others.
My name is Jesse Reed, and I am a meatball sub. Yeah. Actor. I mean, I'm an actor. Fuck, I always do that. Shit.
So this is Minute 164 here on Thursday. So glad to have you guys back.
Yeah, so great. Thanks to be back. Mm-hmm. Glad to be back. However you phrase that.
Thanks
in English.
To be having me.
Yes. So you too.
So Minute 164 starts with the device detonating in New York City and ends with Dr. Manhattan and Silk Spectre surveying the damage in New York.
Not to immediately take this to a downer place here.
But you're about to.
The city does get destroyed right here, so.
Yeah. Kind of depressing.
Is there going to be a point in time where seeing cities get destroyed won't, like, make people of my age range, our age range, a little uncomfortable?
Yeah. I totally get that feeling when in movies like Man of Steel or stuff like this, pretty much any big superhero movie over the last couple of years with the destruction in cities, it does feel a little weird to watch.
Like maybe it'll be a point when, like, my generation's dead or just really old and no one cares what we think anymore. Like I imagine maybe if this was like the 50s or something, maybe the iconography of mushroom clouds might elicit the same sort of.
Yeah,
but isn't that the whole point? It's like you wouldn't want to be in a world where we're all. I mean, I guess we are kind of desensitized as a whole to that and to all sorts of types of violence and stuff, you know? I mean,
sure.
Compared to what we should be reeling from the shit we can even see in commercials, you know? Mm. But I don't know. I just feel like you wouldn't want to not feel anything when you see it. And yeah, the whole reason that they put it was because they want you to feel.
Yeah.
You know? I'm just thinking in particular in relation to 9/11, which we were discussing a little bit in the previous minute.
Obviously,
just a particular... There's a particular, I don't know, emotion or something that the notion of destroying skyscrapers, particularly in New York, tends to stick in my head at least. And having read the reviews for Man of Steel, I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably, think of the book. The city doesn't get destroyed in the book because. Yeah. You know, 9/11 imagery was not a thing in 1984 or 85 when he was, writing this. So, you know, I like the decision to make that connection here, I suppose.
Yeah. And even though they make the connection, it's not as blatant. I know the buildings being knocked over was maybe a little more in the previous minute, but... If you watch that very closely, it almost looks just a touch, I'm going to say cartoony, but I don't mean for it to sound like a pejorative. Mm. It is in just the correct side of the uncanny valley, I think, that it doesn't make me really uncomfortable.
Sure.
In the way that like Man of Steel's building destruction makes you a little uncomfortable. Because like Man of Steel's building destruction really looks like...
Yeah.
What a building looks like when you destroy it, because we know what a building looks like when you destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just on the other side of non-verisimilitude that it's the right level of uncomfortable, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think as opposed to sort of the wrong sort of uncomfortable.
Sure.
Anyway.
Well, we'll also come to a time where it's all going to be indistinguishable. We're all going to be on the other side of the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Too.
So at 5 seconds into this minute, you know, we're seeing Bernie and Bernard get, you know, lifted up in the air here, and they're just vaporized, just gone. And at first I thought, I remember the equivalent scene in the book where you see some people, you know, same thing happens. They get vaporized, and the as they kind of fade away, it resembles the blood splatter from, you know, the pin. The shape of it is meant to match the blood splatter from the pin. And if you freeze frame it here at second five, the shape that Bernie and Bernard take, it totally resembles the blood splatter. And I love that they do that, because I know when you just watch it and you don't pause it or anything, it goes by too quickly to really notice. So I love that they included that here without having to do this as a super slow-mo, you know.
Which second are you paused at?
Second five. And you kind of scroll between five and six. Hmm. If you can.
Yeah, I can kind of see it a little bit. So I was going to ask if Jesse was the left eye, if he was the TLC of the group. But
I'll be Aaliyah. That's fine. Yeah, that's fine with me.
Yeah, okay. I can kind of see that a little bit. It's evocative without being blatant.
Yeah, but going back to the what's actually happening here, you know, definitely want to talk about the embrace of the Bernies, as I like to think of it. And it's sad that they both get vaporized, but I love getting to see that it's, you know, they go out together, and it's, I think it's also meant to be a nod to the lover's embrace that we see throughout the book. At a few points you see this, I guess it's a graffitied, you know, silhouette of two lovers embracing, which is meant to be a nod to the Hiroshima like shadows that were cast on the walls when that blast goes off. You see the shadows that people leave behind, and that is meant to, you know, be evocative of that nuclear holocaust. So I think this is meant to be a nod to that. So I like that it's at least that's what I get from it. So
I would agree.
I was hoping maybe, Jesse, if you had any, you know, you talked about this a little bit and filming this, you know, I didn't know if you had any other thoughts
So this was all sort of shot in one long sequence, beginning with the Bernie and Bernard portion. They sort of shot it in pieces all the way through over the course of a couple of days to this explosion. And like I said, if you were listening to the last episode, they had a green screen behind that entire set, which was massive. And as far as that moment is concerned, the right when it explodes, Jay and I picked a spot together in the huge, gigantic wall. What they were actually were train cars stacked up on top of each other, and I think it. If my memory serves me, which it probably doesn't, there were about 10, and they all in front of it, they draped a green screen down below it. And so we found a spot, and I think there was also a crane. There was a crane with a big light. So I think we were sort of looking near the crane somewhere, and we found sort of the exact right same spot to look. And then they blocked us, you know, to walk to that area. And then we shot all the way up to the explosion. Now, they also, that day, they shot about 60, or no, they shot about 10 or 15 extras to look like a lot more around the cars and stuff. And they all get lifted off the ground. They do that digitally. But in order to do our lift up, where we get lifted up off the ground, like I've mentioned earlier, 6 months later, they brought us to a studio, and they put us in harnesses. And they actually lifted us up, you know, about 6 or 10 feet up off the ground on the harness. And they, much like the guy with the trigger on the briefcase, I think it was the same guy, actually. He was just pulling us so that we would kind of rotate into a circle and show, you know, I think, I didn't know if it showed us rotating when we were floating, but I guess they wanted to get every angle. One other thing, too, that I remember is, so I went, the first time I went with my mom, and the second time to the studio, I went with my dad, and we had some sort of free time. and we were like roaming around the studio. I mean, I barely knew what I was looking at. I'd read the novel already, but I guess where we were poking around, they had my dad. He's like, "Here, take this. It's a keepsake," and he handed me a handful of glass, and we were in Ozymandias's terrarium after the hand had gone through.
Oh, okay.
And and like broken the glass, and so they'd already shot that. Yeah. And it was crazy. I don't have it anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think I even kept it.
Ah.
I was like, why would I need glass? God, well, it was like candy glass. So it was all, sure. You could tell it had been tempered or something. None of it was sharp. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, even that, they had it all planned out. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So for the talk of the squid, I would like to say that it's at this point, and you're referencing it with how it looks in the book, that, you know, on that, in the, it's like six panels long.
Yeah.
And over to the side, on the left side, we have Institute for Extra Spatial Studies. And
yeah.
Then in the next issue is when we see the actual squid sticking out of this building.
Mm-hmm.
So this is to not, you know, to, I have to use a word. I mean, that's what it really represents. Ground zero.
Yeah.
The exact point, you know, in a book is where the Bernies are.
Yeah. And you can, stand. I think you can see it from the comic book, the Institute for Extra Spatial Studies. You can see it in what they shot too.
Yeah. Well, but see, the thing here is that the blast point is there. Further down at Times Square. I mean, this all indications between what we've seen last minute and just now is that, you know, a couple, at least blocks, if not more, quite a few, maybe, where this is supposed to be in relation to, you know, that in the movie, the Ground Zero, you know, point is right there in front of the Flatiron Building in Times Square.
Yeah. Flatiron Building is what, the triangular one, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
So is that on 47th Street?
I don't feel like it's in Times Square.
I
do know, I definitely mapped where the newsstand was way back. I guess probably first time we ever saw it.
Sure.
I mean, it's within a blast radius of Times Square, as we see here, but it's definitely
in the blast radius.
Yeah, I'd have to go back to my notes from those minutes to find out where the newsstand is positioned. I want to say it's closer to like 34th Street, closer to that Empire State Building. So it's like right at the edge.
Yeah,
of the
I
blast
feel like
radius.
It's close to the Empire State Building.
Yeah,
where they are, because I'm only going based off of memory.
Yeah,
but I've seen this portion a thousand times because it's my demo reel.
Yeah,
but isn't the sort of center of the explosion? It's right near the Empire State Building, isn't it? Or is
well,
it? Am I just
the center is Times Square, and then like it goes out the it almost reaches the Empire State Building, but doesn't quite.
Okay,
so that's what I was saying yesterday with like. How I drew out the little map with the what I assume is about the blast radius, and it goes from all the way up from 57th Street down to 37th, and Empire State Building is on 34th Street, so it's like just shy
Since
of a
just
few
just on
streets.
The other side, so it really would be right there, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But it's where the squid is transported into in the book that. It's that immediate area. I mean, within like half a block, even not even a whole block, probably half a block is where people get disintegrated.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's even, I mean, because there's other people right there that are just all lying around, bloody, and mostly dead.
Yeah.
Whereas it makes sense to, you know, I mean, I really do like how this is done in this movie, that the blast occurs. A couple, if not a few blocks away, probably. And there's this time that is then allowed for the radius for it to come out. And there's this chance for the Bernies and the other people to say their last goodbyes and so forth.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's much also, more cinematic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also a benefit of Zack Snyder's propensity for slow-mo, because if you're watching the background behind everybody as they're reacting in this minute and the previous minute, it's slow-mo, it's slow motion, so it is maybe a couple of seconds, but, you know, doing in slow motion, you're giving everyone a little bit of a time to, giving the audience a time to kind of curtain call everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing that, you know, I've said it before. I really like the difference here between the book and the movie. You know, it makes sense that they spent so much time setting up the Dr. Manhattan energy, and that's what this is. You know, essentially that's what this is from. The squid would have required a lot more setup. You know, that I just don't know that they had time really to do. That's not to say they couldn't have done it, but, you know, fitting in the movie that we get, we can only assume how it would have taken shape.
Yeah.
And the one thing I think we lose is, you know, like Eric mentioned, you know, when you go to this issue of the book, it's six entire full pages dedicated to this destruction.
Ooh, destruction, yeah.
And, you know, it's full of color. I mean, and it's full of
traumatizing.
Yeah, it's full of bodies.
It really fucks you up when you're going through it. Yeah,
It's full of bodies and blood and color and then finally you get on that last page and you see this like beak of a squid and it's like, what the hell is going on here? You know, but then obviously you start to understand what's going on, but. You know, I will say again, like coming down to the color of this movie, here we get a big gray crater eventually. Once we, you know, after the Nixon stuff, like we just get a big crater, and you know, you don't have the bodies, and you don't have you have destruction, no doubt. You don't have the people, and I do feel like, not that I want to see people. Bodies necessarily, but it just lacks the color, I think. And I've harped on that enough, I think, here towards the end of the movie, just the lack of color at certain points in the movie. But I think you lose the sense that people were here, not just buildings.
The humanity of that magnitude of destruction. Yeah.
But I mean, you can't have bodies lying around because they would have been vaporized, you know, so you can't have them when you do the vaporizing energy ball. So
so
I don't know, it's I like it, and I but I also feel like that we're missing something.
I like the fact that not having the squid, it simplifies things.
Yeah,
you know, the notion is that Dr. Manhattan was supposed to be our nuclear deterrent and our greatest protector. You know, he is our Superman, for lack of a better word. And so essentially the notion that the world unifies to protect itself from the thing that it thought was protecting it is, I think, more interesting than the world protecting itself from, like, an alien invasion or an alien menace or a genetically engineered, you know, squid monster. Also, on top of the fact, you could also point out, well, if the squid monster comes, why can't Dr. Manhattan do something about it?
Right.
But
yeah.
True. I feel like the solution that they came up with, I mean, the squid, the Manhattan, Dr. Manhattan explosion is like just, you said simplifies it. It's cleaner in every sense of the word. It's cleaner visually, which I think mattered. Like, I think they would have had an even harder time explaining it. They would have had a harder time selling it as a sort of a blockbuster movie, which they already had their work cut out for them to do that, which, I mean, really anyone financing something that gigantic and expensive would have to have sort of a broad appeal. So in order to, like, I mean, the idea of packaging what you read in Watchmen and the fact that that happened to a point, and we did have to lose one thing, which was the monster. But I mean, think about how, tell me a world where there would have been like bloody billions of bloody half dead people, right. You know, that would have been too much for people. I mean, it's already got a blue floppy dick flopping around everywhere throughout the whole movie. I mean, it's a hard enough sell as it is.
Sure.
You know, but I also don't think that it would have been as easily and resolutely explained as it was. I mean, in the novel, they had all that time to set it up. If you take it out, it's just, and also the Dr. Manhattan solution. I mean, that it being that instead, it's the best thing you could. I mean, you couldn't think of something better than that.
Yeah.
Because it really does sort of tie it off in a way that the monster didn't have to do either, mm-hmm. but it didn't do that.
There's also, I think, a philosophical relevance to having it be Dr. Manhattan who is the enemy, because part of essentially why Ozymandias does what he does is because he feels that humanity will not save itself. It is not in human nature to save ourselves. It's in our nature to destroy ourselves. So he is essentially trying to force humanity to do something that is against their own nature. So essentially getting us to reject the superheroes in a way, to reject Dr. Manhattan as a savior and a protector, which is what humanity had been doing, mm-hmm. Is also getting humanity to reject our instincts and our human nature.
Yeah.
Heavy and stuff. I guess we're in the boardroom now?
Yeah, let's...
Since we got through 6 seconds of this minute.
Yeah. Let's jump over to the war room.
Jesus Christ, Arthur! Baru! The great taste of Charleston Chew.
I want to highlight, I really like the performance here by Frank Novak as Kissinger.
Okay.
The way he's not only is he reeling at the loss of life, but the ramifications of this, you can see it, you know, it's the whole nonverbal thing, the show don't tell, you know, it is dawning on him. You know, a god level entity has perpetrated an act of war against humanity, and there is really little to nothing they can do to defend themselves.
Well, shit.
You know, like, you can see that on his face. He's like, oh my god, Dr. Manhattan has just decided to start killing us.
Yeah.
We can do nothing to stop this.
You know, well, and yeah, just by saying, you know, that wasn't a nuke.
Yeah.
You know, I like, of course, Nixon thinks that was a Soviet missile, and he would have every reason to think that. You know, obviously, it's all been apparently, seemingly, it's all been leading to that. So it is.
The Ruskies are shooting at us now. Maru.
That's great.
What if that would have happened? I don't think Nixon was prepared for a nuclear strike. I don't think he would have been able to. I think he would have crumbled under the. I mean, he barely handled the presidency without a nuclear strike.
I wonder what exactly anyone would do in that situation. I mean, the only thing I think that anyone could really think to do is, well, did it come from where we think it came from? Yeah, okay, shoot a nuke back at them, I guess. I mean,
that's what anyone would do.
Yeah. Yeah, but I like, or I guess we see this blast radius on Nixon's war room map here, and it shows this like shockwave extending as far out as Philadelphia, almost to Washington, D.C. And, I mean, obviously, you know, this isn't the size of the destruction, but I could believe that there's some sort of energy, you know, pulse or energy wave that goes that far. I mean,
yeah, like an earthquake or something.
Yeah, like I've heard, you know, actual explosion, you know, from like an electrical transformer exploding, you know, in a, you know, a couple miles away, and you can hear it, and everyone gets on Facebook like, did you hear that? You know?
Oh yeah. In Queens.
Stuff like that. Yeah. Happened. Oh yeah. Yeah. Just recently. Yeah. You had that big one.
It looked like Watchmen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess then if we're talking about yesterday we talked about how the, basically the, like the complete destruction radius was that sort of what 57th down to about
34th. Just north of there.
And then I guess just lesser levels of destruction. So like not enough destruction to level the Empire State Building, but mm-hmm. you know, enough to certainly have it be felt all the way out.
Sure. They definitely need to replace some windows on Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was also thinking, there are real ramifications to this type of attack that make me think that the world is not going to go on as smoothly as Ozymandias thinks. You know, sort of like when you deconstruct the end of Infinity War and you go like, wait, if we just killed half of everything, like now, like all these pets have no owners and, you know, so on and so forth.
The real ramifications of all that happening.
Or, you know, like if you kill half of, or, you know, if the mother gets killed, then who's taking care of the baby and so on and so forth. You know, if you just level several of the world's major financial centers, you know, if you're talking about London, New York, Paris, Hong Kong, there's a number of stock exchanges there.
Yeah. It looks like real pressure point.
Yeah. And this is a time period where, you know, the financial industry was still in the process of going analog to digital. You know, nowadays, all that information is offsite in redundant servers, going to be in at least two different server banks in different parts of the country. Usually somewhere in the Midwest and somewhere out west. But back then, a whole lot of their records would have still been on paper. So that's a lot of credit records, stock ownership records. You know, not, and that's entirely just talking about the financial industry that just went up in, I was going to say up in smoke, but up in blue lightning. You know, the blowback from something like this is, or the fallout is, not inconsequential at all.
And that could have been a big factor in choosing these cities. You know, maybe it's not just about shocking the people into all being afraid of Dr. Manhattan. It could have been a plan of Ozymandias's to, you know, target these specific places and to help, I guess, take everyone back a few steps, maybe.
Yeah, although, given the blast radius that we highlighted yesterday, that would not have hit.
Okay, that's true.
At that point. Yeah. But you know, all those companies, and I know obviously they've consolidated a lot since then, but like your JP Morgan, your Chase's, your Bank of America, so on, they all have major offices, you know, all over the island of Manhattan.
But still, so, with the gravity, I mean, we're probably talking about at least 1 million people died or more.
Yeah, and that's like probably reasonable.
Yeah, if you just hit that portion. So, like, that's, I think that's enough people that we would be, as a civilization, I mean, if you, I hate to compare it to 9/11, but if you think about the, you know, the collective trauma that it caused us around the world, even, I mean, I'm Canadian and even everybody in the world knows where they were when that happened, right? So, if it, I mean, nothing of that magnitude has even come close, has been has ever happened in an instant. I think we would be so screwed up. 9/11
was a few thousand people, I think.
Like 5,000. Like 23 or something, or maybe 5,000 or something. But still, like, we would be, I think we would be so reactionary that we would be the biggest danger to ourselves. Even if Veidt didn't have to do anything else, we would destroy ourselves after that.
And we've talked about the blast radius of the crater, I think, right? You know, is essentially what you came up with, right?
Yeah.
That's really just the crater.
Yeah.
So, like, look at second 36, and there's even the seconds previous, just previous to that, where it's zoomed, it's further out, not on Dr. Manhattan, but then 36 it gets close up on Dr. Manhattan, but you see behind him. You know, I mean, you know, that's just the bottom portion of a skyscraper. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah.
You know, because we saw all those skyscrapers that were, you know, breaking in half and bending over. And
yeah, the damage even goes further than.
Yeah, right. That's a lot of damage. I mean.
Yeah. They were sort of dominoes, falling like dominoes.
Yeah, because it definitely sent out like a shockwave, pushing a lot of the buildings over, and then it vaporized everything. So it was kind of a two-level sort of blast.
I don't know how much worse being vaporized would have been. You know, I don't know if you would hope to be crushed to death by a falling building and debris so that you don't have to experience being vaporized, or being vaporized is
vaporized.
Yeah, I think vaporizing.
Listen, make it quick.
Well, we don't know the specifics of how Dr. Manhattan's vaporization works. You could be suffering for 2 hours after you're dead.
That's true.
Well, I mean, the same could be said for any way you die.
Yeah, that is true.
And Thanos is snapped. I mean, there's all these theories about, they're sent to another dimension. They're not really dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's that theory too. Well, with Spider-Man and the Black Panther.
Oh, I had the grimmest theory about that, because people have said, well, of course they're going to undo all of it because they've got Spider-Man movies and Guardians movies they're shooting. What if all of those movies are basically just prequels for Infinity War? Like, they're all set right before Infinity War. The same way that Ant-Man and the Wasp is set right before Infinity War.
Right.
What if all that of them basically...
That would be such a dick move.
If they all basically end with the start of Infinity War.
They did do that with Ant-Man.
Everyone is dead.
Nah, they're not dead.
They wouldn't do that, because they got to replace Cap and Iron Man and all those who are moving on.
Yeah.
But, exactly.
Are we done with... I guess we're done with Nixon. We've been kind of talking about their surroundings.
Yeah, the only question I had related to Nixon here was, in this continuity, was Ford still the VP into Nixon's fifth term? Do we know
that? I don't know that they ever referenced the VP.
I mean, I don't see anyone in here who looks like they're in this war room who looks like Ford or something passing for Ford. But
or even
that
supposed
also
to be a VP.
Yeah, that also could either be no actor was made up to look like him, or he's on a different side of the room, or he's in a different room. Who knows?
Or, just in a different place altogether. So that there's isn't that kind of thing when they get
designated survivor? Yeah. Oh, my God. How does this keep coming?
That's what they had for the State of the Union that just happened last week or whenever that was.
Yeah.
That
designated
survivor
has come up yet again.
Who's the energy secretary? He was the one that was designated.
Yeah. I mean, it would sort of make sense, especially if you're in a situation where war, they're in this war room right now. War is a distinct, imminent possibility. So let's not have the president and vice president in the same place.
That sounds realistic, too. He could be in like Idaho or something.
Yeah, a different bunker somewhere else.
I think that.
Or that.
Like the backup. If this war room were to be destroyed right now, you would lose your President Nixon, your Secretary of State? I think Kissinger was Secretary of State.
I think he was,
Yeah, and, you would lose whatever other Joint Chiefs and assorted leaders are in there. But then somewhere in another bunker, Ford is hunkered down with the other, with other heads of the government.
Skeleton,
Nixon left Ford at the White House and just said, I'm going out for cigarettes. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Well, because otherwise then you're left with Kiefer Sutherland, who's been sitting in a boardroom as, like the Secretary of Urban Planning, and now he's in charge of the country.
All right. Should we jump to where Dr. Manhattan and Silk Spectre teleport into the conveniently right on the edge of the this crater. So John has a good sense of space and where he teleports.
Where did they teleport when they went off to Mars? They were in Night Owl 2's residence or his owl cave or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Do we know that is in New York somewhere?
It is, yeah.
So did he try to teleport right back to where he left her? Because if he did, then that means the Owl Cave is also vaporized.
No, because one of the last, few minutes of the movie is going to take place in
Dan's
apartment.
So then it just raises the question of why did he teleport her back here instead of back to where he left her?
I don't know.
Or back to where they left from.
Yeah.
But. They teleported to a place where it was plot convenient.
Right.
Yeah.
Because how does it work with Nightcrawler? He has to he can only teleport to somewhere he's been before.
Or he can see.
Yeah. Okay. That's also, you know, depending on the continuity.
Oh, sure. Sure.
I mean, if he can see where he's got, I'm going to go with the movies, even though they don't even have the greatest continuity with each other. If he can see where he's going, he's good.
Yeah.
If he's been there before, he's good.
Right.
If
right.
it's neither of those, he might work, might not.
It's like 50-50, 70-30 or something.
Yeah.
It's like he might
he
be able
could
to.
Wind up in a wall.
Well, taking the chance of, I think I said it before very early in this in the minutes, the chance of being inside a water tank like in on the Enterprise.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
In the reboot,
but he could just phase through it. It's really the people that he takes with him that he has to worry that
he'd be,
you know,
fine.
Her leg isn't going to be inside of a block of concrete right now.
So. Yeah, like Nightcrawler.
Well, yeah. I mean, if her leg does wind up inside of a block of concrete, he can always, you know, fiddle with the matter and fix it or do whatever.
Yeah, turn the concrete into Elmer's glue.
But,
or,
you know,
make something less silly like that.
Turn the concrete into a cast.
Yeah. Or
the
stairs.
Just broke.
Stairs.
But even, like, saying that he could just manipulate, you know, her leg or whatever, he doesn't even have the courtesy to manipulate her stomach so that she doesn't get sick every time they do this. Yeah. It's
well, what typically, so I'm assuming it's some kind of motion sickness that she's getting.
I think so. Yeah.
So, what caused motion sickness is usually inner ear related, isn't it? So I guess it would actually be her inner ear fluid, I guess, that he's manipulating.
Yeah, maybe. Or just the displacement of all your atoms to a different part of the globe might have something to do with it, but I'm not sure about
this
that.
Was a jump from Mars to here.
This was a different
one.
Part of the universe.
Yeah.
Solar system.
Yeah. So he starts off by saying interference, cataclysmic interference. And it's an interesting choice of words because it's so cold and devoid of any concern for the lives that were lost. And I mean, again, it still fits within what we've seen from him. But like very recently, we've seen him start to come around a little bit and appreciate at least the miracle of Lori's life. But it doesn't sound like he's all that concerned yet with anyone else still. So
Adrian interfered with his ability to see into the future. Right. Did he also interfere with his ability to see into the past?
I don't think so.
Because
I think it's this physical space in New York.
Limits his power,
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, because theoretically then he knows what he's about to teleport into. Because then theoretically he's seen the past and when they're about to leave Mars, he knows the bombs have just gone off or the bombs are going, things are exploding as we're having this conversation right now. The one where he's looking into her past.
I think he just can't see what's going on over there.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So they're about to go back into what he doesn't know because it's the future, but it's also his own energy. So even if it's the present, it's kind of discombobulating.
Yeah, I think because we start out the movie and Rorschach goes to tell them, and that's when we first meet Dr. Manhattan, and he says he can't look into the future because of the tachyons. I think he means he can't look any further than this moment right here because he's standing in New York and there's been a sudden blast of all this energy and there's a residual tachyon energy kind of left, I guess, hanging in the air, so to speak. So there's just a fuzzy idea of this place. He knows he's going to be somewhere in the future where there's been this energy released, but he can't see anything, you know, past this, I think, because it's where he's physically standing. If he would have, in the normal timeline, teleported to, you know, somewhere in the middle of Iowa, he probably would have been fine, but he wouldn't have had a reason to go there. He had a reason to go here because there was all this destruction. but that's what's also causing the blockage.
In the original comic, did they actually name check tachyons or?
Yes.
Didn't they?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah. I was just...
So that's kind of interesting because the term tachyons didn't. It was first coined in 1967. Mm. Obviously, Star Trek used the heck out of that word as plot, plot spackle.
Sure.
In Next Generation on, I don't know if they ever really used tachyons in the original series Star Trek at this point. So when Alan Moore was writing it, tachyons would not have been referenced that often in. Mm. Popular culture.
Sure.
Just, I think it's at this point in time when Alan Moore's writing it, tachyons are kind of a deep cut reference as far as a science term goes.
Sure.
It's
just good research.
Good on them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we just talked about a week or two ago, even the smiley face on Mars wasn't known about that much longer, that much, earlier than the movie, or not the movie, when the story was written. They just, must have done enough research to hear about this thing that I think it was discovered in 1978, I think. So,
wow. I don't really know much about Alan Moore, but I'll tell you what I do know is that he probably does his research before he puts to pad.
Yeah.
He grabs an encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. And he goes, nuclear. Okay. ooh, tachyons. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Lori says, I can't believe it happened. And I really like her in this minute. We don't get her a lot. And she doesn't, I think that's the only thing she says. And it's this mix between physically being affected by the Manhattan Transfer, as I think she calls it, and the devastation of what she's seeing. Mm-hmm. So it is a nice blend that Malin Ackerman, I think, pulls off really well of being physically just affected by the jump and
overwhelmed by
a hole in the ground that used to be New York City. That's a lot to take in.
And it's an interesting note that she says, I can't believe it happened. In her mind, her first, because she wasn't performing the investigation with Rorschach and Night Owl, her first thought is not unlike Nixon, that they just blew up New York.
Right.
The Russians just bombed.
And that's what he said, references next when he says this wasn't caused by nuclear warheads, because I think he knows that that's what she assumes it was.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I guess, going back and thinking about it, he assumed that nuclear missiles would be the cause of the tachyon disturbance. So I guess it's even him coming to realize, like, this wasn't nukes. It was.
Yeah, well, I would imagine, given his, that's sort of a case where I believe, like, essentially as soon as he sort of touches down here and determines that it's not nukes, that's the point, I believe, when he probably can look back in time and realize, all the plot that he's been missing.
Oh, okay.
That at that point, once he touches down and, senses that there's not nuclear fallout in the air or whatever it is he figures out, that at that point, then he can look back in time. And all this is in an instant because time is funky and weird for him.
Yeah.
And he can sort of say, at that point, he can look back and see Ozymandias setting 10 years of plot in motion and eventually hitting a button that blows up the city. But yeah.
What would be interesting is if, once he was physically here in this time and present on the edge of this crater surrounded by all that tachyon energy, it would be interesting if now he no longer had the ability to look in his past because now there's suddenly tachyons like present
on either side of his perception.
It's like a wall on one side or the other.
And then he would just be stuck in the moment like Eminem or something.
Yeah.
Drake.
He'd have like clowns to the left of him and jokers to the right.
Sure.
Spectre, here I am. Stuck in the crater with you.
Yeah. There's the episode title.
Yep. I did it again.
Yeah.
Well, did anyone notice in the crater the subway tunnels?
I did, yes.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. That's
yeah. 44 was one, at least.
Oh, yeah. And I know we talked about subway tunnels, you know, again, an hour ago. I don't know. It came up probably when we were somewhere underground with Night Owl's cave, his lair. And I just think movies and TV have taught me that there are subway lines running, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet below the city. And then there's like they're at different levels and there are older ones that are even deeper or whatever, you know, just from watching movies and seeing people go underground.
If the Ninja Turtles have taught me anything.
Basically Ninja Turtles. Yeah. Yeah. So it is interesting. Yeah. You see the two little sections of subway that are kind of bisected, or you see the opening of the artery there. And it's probably, you know, I don't know how tall a subway tunnel is, you know, 15 feet maybe. So you can kind of judge from where the subway tunnel is up to where the street would be, and it might be, you know, maybe 60 to 80 feet below the street. I don't know if that's realistic. But then there's nothing really under that. Like, there's not another subway tunnel, you know, or, you know, far below that either. So it's nice to... Well,
depending on where exactly the subway line is, there, you know, there are certainly some places where there are lots of lines intersecting. And then there are also some places where there's just a line.
Or where where it's just below the street, sort of, I think. Lots of them, or most of them, are
just
maybe
below
not
the surface.
50 or 60, but less than 20.
Okay.
And also, I don't know the history of all of New York's subway lines. So certainly, some of them may be newer. You know, this if this is set in 85, they may not have as many subway lines as New York City does now. Mm. So,
yeah,
right.
Little bit less congestion down there, perhaps.
Anything else on this one?
No, I think we covered this one to death.
It was a good death.
I'm good.
Yeah, it was a bit of a grim play on words.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's see. This is the end of Thursday. So, yeah, Jesse, this is the last stop for you.
Oh, so I guess I got to get off. Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you on, and glad we got to. I don't think we had any of your scenes in the first time you were on. I feel like it was.
Maybe not.
I don't think so. But I'm really glad we got to have you here for such a great, you know, great scene with you. So.
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite minute. But actually, no, that's not true. My favorite minute is when Rorschach dies. I think that's got to be the best for any actor to see that. I mean, yeah. Oh, so good. So
well,
good.
Here, but, we got to cover your death, and then.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a mini version. Maybe one day I'll be able to scream before I get vaporized into blue goop. But for now.
Well,
that's
the thing. Every actor loves to have a good death scene, right?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely, who is it? Sean Bean has 20 different.
Yeah.
He's like all these different death scenes.
Spoiler alert: yeah. Sean Bean dies.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what you're watching.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a place to start, yeah, and I mean this was the first role in a movie that got me, you know, got me going and very much on track. Like I fell in love with this process through this film and what a way to begin. So, thank you guys for having me on. And it was really pleasurable experience for me to revisit that chapter, that event in my life. It was obviously quite pivotal for me. And, you know, when I get going, as I step into the future, I sometimes lose track of the past and where I've been. So it's good. It was good for me to think about that and to look at that again. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome. Glad we could experience that with you.
Yeah.
I want to make sure. Jesse, is there anything you want to plug or anything?
What's the date today?
February 28th.
Oh, okay. So it's February 28th. So that means my show, Mondo Tragic, at the National Black Theater, is in New York. It's in Harlem. So if you find yourself this way, come and see the show. If you go to my Instagram, JesseReed99, I will give you a discount. And I don't know how much it's going to be. But if you come from, like I said last week, if you are like, if you're in Pennsylvania or you're in Connecticut or you're in New Jersey or you're somewhere that's, if you come anywhere from out of New York City, I will buy your ticket and, you know, bring someone and it'll be fun. Okay. This show is about the Mondo genre of film. Eric decides to make a Mondo film about Rachel Dolezal. If you remember who that is, she's the white lady who pretended to be black for many years, and she actually infiltrated the NAACP and was the president of NAACP under the guise of being black for many, many years. So it's a very strange play, but I'm enjoying it so far, and I think you're all gonna enjoy it. So yeah, you can cut as much of that out as you want. To be that long.
It's all good. All right. So, Alex, we'll see you tomorrow. People can check you out all over on
We're on the social media.
Independence Day Minute and
Independence Day Minute, Galaxy Quest Minute, Cleveland and Six. I've got other hypothetical projects that I can plug, but they're still hypothetical right now. You know, if there were 47 hours in the day, I could do all the projects I have in my head, but that's how it always works.
Yeah.
Only you and me both, brother.
Yeah.
All right. The last thing I want to say, I'm still letting the minute play as we're wrapping up, and there's a Easy Boy recliner just at the edge of the crater next to Dr. Manhattan and Silk Spectre. So I just want to leave everyone with that. So
he got raptured.
So until tomorrow. Or, I'm sorry. Is this your minute, Eric?
It's mine.
I'm sorry.
I don't care. Okay, I'll do it. So until tomorrow, when we are back with Alex, and good day to Jesse. Thanks so much.
Yep.
Until tomorrow, who watches The Watchmen? We do.
We do.
We do.
Watchmen are over. Yeah, we are all ages. Yes, we're pushing them through.